And welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We've already heard two cases today with this panel and one other panel, and we're going to hear two more cases. All right, y'all ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's call the first case.
The court will now call William D. Lacey versus City of Fort Worth et al. May it please the court, Mr. Carl McCleary will argue for the appellant. Mr. Thomas D. Grant will argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. Municipal corporations and the entities that they create begin, in for most instances, for most purposes, like any other private corporation. They're not immune from suit unless they are performing some governmental function that the Texas legislature has ordered them to perform for the benefit of the public. And they don't have exclusive jurisdiction that would exclude the district courts of exercising their original constitutional jurisdiction to review agency actions and to hear common law claims or statutory claims, unless, again, the Texas legislature has conveyed through explicit language that exclusive jurisdiction to them. Now, the appellees in this case claim that a single statute does both things and also makes them a state-created entity. Respectfully, it does none of those things. The statute at issue, Article 6243I, does not create the fund or the board, where we are the appellees here. It does not mandate that they provide any benefits, much less disability benefits, to the participating members, and it does not charge any particular group with responsibility for making eligibility for benefits determinations. So it hasn't enjoined any function on the board or the fund. The legislature hasn't enjoined any function on the board or the fund that would make it a governmental function. Similarly, they haven't given, the Texas legislature hasn't given any exclusive jurisdiction to the board to make benefits determinations, eligibility for benefits determinations. It's left that to municipal ordinance. So there is no exclusive jurisdiction, and so there's no deprivation of jurisdiction to the district court. For that reason, regardless of the reasoning behind the district court's decision to grant the plea of the jurisdiction, it should be reversed. Now, the appellees begin in this analysis by suggesting the analysis of municipalities does not apply to them. Again, they resort to 6243I, and they say that it creates the fund. This is simply not true. As Judge McBride said in the City of Houston case and as the Texas Supreme Court said in the Howerton case, describing the history of the fund, this fund was created in 1945 by municipal ordinance of the City of Fort Worth, as was the board at the same time. Article 6243I, which has no statutory predecessor, came into existence in 2007, so there's several decades difference between the creation of the fund and the creation and the enactment of I. And also importantly, to read the statute itself, it makes clear that it doesn't recodify or recreate the fund. It actually says that it simply applies to funds that had already been established by municipal ordinance before it went into effect. And it doesn't do anything, it doesn't create an entirely new set of procedures or administrative means of administering the board or the fund. It has simply some supplemental requirements that relate to the composition of the board, or relate to the manner in which the plan can be amended, and also some very minor appellate jurisdiction given to the board specifically that is not applicable here. So to say that it's created by the state, that it's a state-created entity, just belies the terms of the statute itself, as well as its non-comprehensive, non-requirement, non-mandatory nature. And that is, you know, tomorrow the city of Fort Worth could get rid of its fund or its board, and it wouldn't be violating the statute. Now, so that makes it a municipally created entity. And if that's the case, we should apply the same standards for a municipally created entity as we should for the municipality itself. Its immunity, if any, is derivative of the immunity that the municipality should enjoy. And whether you're talking about the Texas Tort Claims Act, which applies to the tort claims in this case, or at least some of the tort claims in this case, or the common law standard of immunities, we determine whether something's a governmental or proprietary function, and thereby whether you have immunity, depending upon two different characteristics. One, has the function been enjoined by statute upon the municipality or the municipally created entity to perform? If it isn't ordered, if it isn't required, then it is not a governmental function. And in addition, the function that the municipality is performing, or the municipally created entity on behalf of the municipality, has got to be one that has a geographic scope beyond the municipality itself. It's got to be for the general public. If it's simply for the benefit of the inhabitants of the city, then it is not a governmental function. And this, again, Article 6243I fails both of those two tests. It's not mandatory. It doesn't require that the city of Fort Worth have a fund. It doesn't mandate what benefits must be provided under the fund, and it doesn't control the standards for determining when those benefits are provided. It doesn't require that any particular entity be responsible for determining benefits. It certainly doesn't assign those benefits to the board itself. I mean, those benefits determinations to the board itself. So it, as a voluntary undertaking by the city of Fort Worth, it is a proprietary function. It is something that they have decided in their discretion to perform. Now, the statute certainly does do things. Again, it requires a certain composition of the board. It says that certain places on the board will be held by certain members. It does say that if you're going to be amending the plan, you've got to do certain things, especially if it's going to relate to changes in benefits actuarially. But these are procedural things that are not comprehensive. You know, the large measure of how the plan is administered, funded, and controlled, it really comes down to what it's said in the ordinance, in the plan, in city ordinance, in the plan, and in the board's own administrative procedures. So again, it's not mandatory. It's also not got the geographic scope that you would expect of a governmental function. This is a statute that applies only in certain municipalities, those with more than 500,000 people, but less than whatever. There are other statutes that apply to, you know, larger cities, and there's so many of them that it's hard to tell exactly where one begins and one ends. But this one only applies to the city of Fort Worth. And it's only an employment benefit relating to certain of the city employees. So it doesn't even apply to all the citizens of the city of Fort Worth, and it certainly doesn't apply to the public at large, the citizens of the state of Texas at large. So it doesn't pass the geographic scope test, as well as the compulsion test that you'd need for governmental function. That means that the municipality has no immunity from any of the claims that Mr. Layton has alleged here, because whatever functions may be enjoined by Article 6243I on either the fund or the board, they don't dictate the way in which his benefits are to be determined, or who is to determine them.
Before you leave that point, sir, I'd like to be careful I'm understanding what I just heard you say, and that is that the way that 6243I is drafted, it's what may be sometimes called a bracket bill in the legislature, which means that it is structured in such a way with the lower population limit and a higher population limit that it only applies to the city of Fort Worth.
That's my understanding, and that is not an expert understanding, but it's just from what I've read, is that it was...
You're the best expert I've got in front of
me now. I got to tell you, I don't understand. I've read these statutes, all of them, and I don't understand all of them in their absolute particulars. But yeah, it is my understanding that this one's really built for the city of Fort Worth.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Yeah. And, I mean, and there's nothing in the statute that suggests that. Like you said, it's based on population.
Well, none of the bracket bills say it's a city of so-and-so. It always talks about population brackets, and
right.
It just usually only fits the ones that are intended to be covered by the legislators who are working on that bracket bill.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, it's very specific, but it's also not exclusive.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's a set of supplemental requirements. And I think that's also important because it envisions the existence of the fund by ordinance and the things that it's already put into being.
Okay.
If that makes sense, you know, it's changing certain things, it's putting some procedures in place, but it doesn't do anything here. It's not intended to be comprehensive, and it's not intended to create a plan, a fund, you know, or a board. That said, if we lose on both of those points before you today, there's two grounds we still think we still have defeated immunity. One is that we've pleaded a contract claim under the local government code, and also that this that all of Mr. Layton's claims should survive because he's alleged ultra vires acts against the board and the fund. And even when immunity applies, there's an exception to immunity for instances in which a government entity exceeds the discretion given to it by whatever law is applicable. And I'm not planning on spending a lot of time on those issues unless the court has specific questions. I'd like to move on to the exclusive jurisdiction point, which is similar. The appellees claim that they have that the board is given exclusive jurisdiction in this case over all of Mr. Layton's claims, not only its benefit determinations, not only his tort claims, not only his contract claims, not only his constitutional claims, which I find very strange, but those are all given to him, all given to the board in its exclusive jurisdiction, and its decisions relating to those are final and unreviewable in a district court.
They specifically accepted the constitutional claims.
They did specifically accept
okay,
the
so
constitutional
they didn't,
claims.
They're not
Although
saying.
That's not entirely true, because the violations of municipal ordinance are also constitutional claims. They don't accept those because that's an allegation of an ultra vires act, which is an allegation of an unconstitutional action in violation of the separation
claims.
Of powers. There's also the due process claims, which they have not claimed are exclusively given to the board. But they do claim that their tort claims and the contract claims, as well as the benefits determinations themselves and our municipal claims, are all given exclusively to the board. But they begin in the wrong step in their analysis on that point. They assume that any agency determination is unreviewable unless something specifically is given allowing review. That is simply not the case. When you're talking about abrogating the original exclusive constitutional jurisdiction of the district courts, only a coordinate branch of government can do that. Only the Texas legislature can do that. And it must assign exclusive jurisdiction to an entity. So if Fort Worth decided these things ought to be final and unreviewable, that's fine as a matter of administrative law within the Fort Worth's own administrative procedures, but they can't bar the original jurisdictions of the district courts of Texas. Now they have not pointed to any legislative conveyance of power over anything related to Mr. Layton's claims, much less, you know, not even about the benefits determinations, much less the common law claims that he's also alleged that have been exclusively given to the board. What they raise is a provision in Article 6243I. That is actually a very, very narrow and should not be misinterpreted piece of jurisdiction. And there is some jurisdiction conveyed to the board. It is final and exclusive to the extent it's applicable. But as the Texas Supreme Court said in the Subaru case, which we've cited in our brief, we don't presume anything about exclusive jurisdiction. The court has to spell it out exactly and explicitly. There's no implication, and we're not going to read these acts broadly. We're going to read them very narrowly to protect the original jurisdiction of the Texas courts. And the provision that they're talking about, and that is section 2.01 of 2.01C of the Article 6243I, it relates to a specific kind of determination. It's a little bit, statutory languagey, but it says that all determinations relating to whether a person is a participating member, and that's the statutory phrase, participating member, are given to the board in their appellate jurisdiction. They're still anticipating that someone else will be making the determination in the first instance, which you would expect in these kinds of determinations, because a participating member is one who's entitled to partake in the fund. That is to say, a participating member is someone who is a full-time employee of the city of Dallas, of the city of Fort Worth.
Council, your red light has come on.
Oh, I didn't see it come on. Okay.
So you will have time to continue here shortly.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Brandt. I represent the Fort Worth City Employees Retirement Fund and its Board of Trustees. This court should affirm the district court's decision on the plea of the jurisdiction for three reasons. First, the board's decision was final and not reviewable. Second, Mr. Layton has not alleged a viable claim under the Texas Constitution. And then finally, the fund and the board are entitled to governmental immunity from Mr. Layton's claims. A great deal of time, both in the briefing of Mr. Layton and in the oral presentation, has been spent on the governmental immunity aspect. This case can be decided without even reaching that issue because of the first two issues I mentioned. The final and not reviewable issue is directly taken from the law, the administrative law, and its application to 6243I. If you look at that section that you were just cited to, it has to do with eligibility, and it says that decision is final. Now, the question becomes, does that apply directly to this situation of disability pension benefits or not? And the answer is either yes or no. But if it doesn't, if the answer is yes, then the case is over. If the answer is no, then the case is over, but for a different reason. If the case is, if you're saying, well, that doesn't apply, then it means that the statute is silent. And the case law says that if the statute is silent as to the appellate review, then there is no appellate review, that the decision is full, is final, and non-reviewable. That ends all of the discussion except the constitutional issue. There are two possible sources of constitutional violation. One is the federal and the other is the state. The plaintiff has not pled any federal constitutional claims. The plaintiff has only asserted state constitutional claims. We pointed out when we filed our plea of the jurisdiction, we pointed out, of course, the final and not reviewable issue, and then we moved rapidly to the next issue, which was the Texas constitutional issue. And we pointed out to the district court that the pleadings were asking for money damages for a violation of the Texas Constitution. That is not a viable claim under many cases, the first of which was the City of Beaumont versus Bouillon case. But that line of cases is solid. There is no claim for money damages under the Texas Constitution. After we made that assertion in our plea and was before the court, the plaintiff then amended. They had filed a first amended petition in which they still asserted claim for damages under the Texas Constitution. And that was how it was presented to the district court, was a claim for money damages. It was only when we appear before this court that it becomes an allegation that this is actually an equitable claim, some kind of equitable claim. But it is not. It's a claim for money damages.
And they not plead for reinstatement?
They pled for reinstatement of the benefits.
Okay, but I understand that, and I understand your position that that's asking for money damages, but I think they rely on a case out of this court where someone was reinstated in their job. So the effect of that, and this court held that that was equitable relief, and therefore it wasn't, they could pursue that because it wasn't a legal remedy. So what they were asking for in that case was reinstatement to a status of employed wherein they would receive a salary. In this instance, they're pleading for reinstatement to a status of participating member or eligible for benefits. So what's effectively the difference?
The difference is this. They are not asking for another hearing. They're asking for this court to put them into the position of receiving the benefits, the disability benefits. What the best that they could hope for, if they were to prove some sort of a due process violation, would be to have a proper hearing on the matter. The court would not have jurisdiction to say both, number one, there was a problem with the hearing, it wasn't a fair hearing, and number two, this is the result that should happen with the hearing. No, that's what the board has the jurisdiction to do, to listen to the evidence and to make that determination. So what the best that they could hope for, if they had pled it properly, was to get a new hearing before the board some sort of a declaration that hearing below was not a fair hearing because it lacked due process. But when you look at the facts as they are contained in the record, you see four different hearings, three of which they received notice of all three, but they attended, oh, sorry, of all four, but they attended three of them. And the first one that they attended, the first was a disability committee meeting. That was a small portion of the entire board. And that was on July 10th of 2012. And that was where the disability committee met to consider this issue of whether or not to continue, suspend, or terminate Mr. Layton's disability benefits. The next hearing was that of the entire board, July 12th, 2012. And at that hearing before the board, Mr. Layton and his wife presented evidence. They received notice of that hearing. They attended. They presented testimony and evidence to support their disability claim. And then the board provided Mr. Layton with the videotape that they had reviewed of him. And they provided that to him, that showing his activities that were inconsistent with disability. And then they delayed their decision and waited for the examination by a doctor. All right, that was July of 2012. The next was about 2 months later. There was a disability committee hearing, September 19th of 2012, and that was where Mr. Layton and his wife appeared, presented evidence, and at the conclusion of that, the disability committee recommended the termination of disability benefits. Finally, there was another hearing. That was the final hearing on September 26th of 2012 of the entire board. And at that hearing, they considered all the evidence, including the doctor, including the videotape, including all the evidence they heard, and they issued their finding at that point. And that was the due process that they got. What their burden was before the district court was to prove that the district court had jurisdiction. And in order to do that, they had to get over the final and non-reviewable, but they also had to get past the Texas constitutional issue. They had to say, we have a viable Texas constitutional claim. They admitted to all of these notices. They knew that they had all these notices and opportunities to be heard. They admitted to all the evidence that was available that had been weighed by the board. What they were essentially saying is, we don't agree with what the board did. That's quite different than saying that there was some sort of an illegal situation. And it's only at this stage before this court that they bring up the ultra vires claims, as the court has before it right now is a motion that the plaintiffs have filed in order to lift the stay so that they can amend their pleading below to add an ultra vires claim. It doesn't exist before the court at this time, and we have resisted the motion vigorously because we think that was their opportunity to be heard, and now that they see that they have not met the, that they can't get over the final and non-reviewable, and that they haven't proven a viable Texas constitutional claim, that now they're going and scrambling to get an ultra vires claim pled, and they said if they don't get the stay lifted and the ability to replead, then they're going to sue us separately in another lawsuit for the ultra vires claims, which of course I think would be barred by res judicata if this court were to affirm the district court below. But the issue on the Texas constitutional claim is really kind of twofold. One is the fact that that they have received and admitted to receiving all the proper notice and opportunity to be heard numerous times on this issue. They just they don't agree with what has happened, but that is not a basis for a Texas constitutional claim. If it were, then every one who lost below would have an appeal right because they would be able to say that the judge or the jury was biased against them. That's not the case here. And secondly, and more to your point, Justice Gabriel, about the issue of reinstatement and the equitable remedy, that's not available to them. What's available to them, if anything, would be that they had not had a fair hearing, that it, somehow it had violated their due process rights. Well, the remedy for that due process right is another hearing, a one that gives them the rights they're entitled to. But it doesn't take away the board's authority to weigh that evidence. You get it's essentially like getting a new trial, and you, but still the jury in a trial situation has to weigh the evidence. You don't get to say reversed and rendered in their favor, which is essentially what they're asking for. In the briefing on the issue of final and not reviewable, Mr. Layton's position has been that since he's saying that the statute is silent on that on the issue of final and not reviewable, that was their position in the briefing, and they're saying that since it's silent, that means that it is reviewable. So it's very, very clear that this court either follows the law on that issue and or creates a new set a new law in the administrative field that says if there is silence on the statute, then it means it's reviewable, which would turn the current law on its head. That's why I've focused so much on the final and not reviewable issue, because it disposes of so much and it leaves the court's attention directed only at the Texas constitutional claim. And moving, if we need to, into the governmental immunity issue, I wanted to point out a couple of things. One is that the supposition was that immunity was not the general rule from the common law, and that's wrong. It begins with immunity being the standard rule, and you have to carve out from that immunity. That's one thing I want to point out. But also there's been an emphasis here in oral argument that the contract claim under local government code gives them some relief. What their argument, though, if you look at it carefully, is self-defeating, because they say that this is a contract, a unilateral contract, and that you look at the documents that are establishing this relationship between Mr. Layton and the fund. Well, if you look at those documents, you'll see that there is a section in the ordinance 25-15, which says limitation of legal rights. It says, by virtue of membership in the fund, the member accepts the benefits provided by the fund in lieu of any alleged right at law to sue the city or this fund for damages. So the very act of creating the fund, the very act of creating the contract that has been alleged, in and of itself, just takes away that contract right. So you can see that it is simply not a viable claim. Even if it were otherwise viable, it's not viable because at the very inception of its creation, alleged creation, it, one of the material terms of that contract was you can't sue for damages.
Branch, you're about out of time, but yes. I'd like you to address, if you will, the discussion of the fact that this fund was created in 1943 as opposed to after the effective date of the statute.
Yes.
And the fact that it would have been, at the time it was created, a proprietary action on the part of the city council in adopting the fund, in adopting the plan of the retirement plan.
Yes, the retirement plan was created prior to the enactment of 6243I. That's absolutely correct. And the creation of the plan itself, though, whether it was proprietary or not, I think it was governmental in nature because it was something that was that the government was doing as part of its municipal function. But regardless of whether at that frozen point in time before the enactment of 6243I, regardless of what the decision would be if we asked the question then, it's the imposition of this statutory scheme above the plan, which says this statutory scheme applies to the plan that exists now in the city of Fort Worth, because that's the only one in the bracket, apparently. So in doing so, it lives and dies under the terms of that statute. So regardless of whether in the past it would be considered proprietary, it is now governed by this statutory scheme, which is silent on the issue of appeal. So whether it's proprietary or not.
I'm just only trying to determine if it's your position and the city's position that what happened was when 6243I was passed in 2007, it converted what was previously a proprietary function to a governmental function.
No. My position is that it the administration of the fund is a governmental function, but that issue becomes moot when the statutory scheme is imposed and there is no final appeal of that.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Let's give counsel an extra minute.
To continue where I left off on reviewability, and this is a very important point, eligibility to be a participating member does not imply eligibility to receive benefits. That is to say, and you look at this, if you look at section 1.01 of Article 6243I, it's going to tell you who is a participating member. Those who are entitled to partake of the fund, that is to say full-time employees, not part-time employees. Now, our benefits weren't denied on the basis that he was not a full-time employee. So the board was not exercising its appellate jurisdiction, again, not original jurisdiction, but it's appellate jurisdiction, to make determinations of whether or not someone can be a participating member. That just wasn't before the board. It wasn't part of their decision. So they don't have an exclusive jurisdiction that's going to cover that. Now, to go to the constitutional point, Justice Gabriel, you said it right, and you and Bill, Justice Meyer, you said it both right in Jacobs. And that is, number one, ultimately the remedies, they're talking about the remedies available for these things, may not include monetary damages, but that's something for the trial court to decide in the first instance. For us, it's enough to say we've alleged constitutional claims and that we've sought equitable remedies, and reinstatement is an equitable remedy, just like it was in Jacobs. And that is, we're asking for reinstatement of benefits or reinstatement as a disabled person, and in our entitlement to benefits thereby, and so we can go forward. Now, there's a distinction between whether we're entitled to back pay or forward pay only, you know, reinstatement going forward. And if we're not entitled to back pay, that's fine, but that doesn't deprive the district court of jurisdiction to hear the case. That just ultimately binds the kinds of remedies that the district court can give. Finally, when we're talking about exclusive jurisdiction, they said something strange about our breach of contract claim, and I wanted to address that. It's not in the briefing, so I didn't quite prepare a detailed response to it. But they suggest that by accepting benefits, we waive damages. Well, the damages that we're seeking are reinstatement of the benefits. So we're not seeking anything that's not not compatible with the fund, to say that that's barred or that a contract is barred somehow just because of that disclaimer doesn't make any particular sense. You know, again, going, and I would like to go back to eligibility, about statutory silence, the point that appellees claim. They cite a number of cases on 9 and 10 of their brief, City of Houston, Continental Casualty, Farrell, Little Tex, Mega Child Care. In each instance, you will see when you read them that first the court goes through an analysis to determine whether a kind of exclusive jurisdiction has been provided by the Texas legislature to the agency at issue, regardless of whether it's a state-created or a municipally-created agency. It's got to come from the legislature. An exclusive jurisdiction must be given. And then and only then will we imply that there's no right of appellate review unless it's given by the district court. So again, they're skipping a step in the analysis, and they don't address that point in response. So that's all I really have. And for those reasons, we request that the district courts.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of the silent the argument that's made by the city, that if the statute is silent, then there is no right of review.
Well,
how
again,
do you address that?
Agencies are not given exclusive jurisdiction willy-nilly. They're not. They don't just decide to take things on, or, you know, by ordinance they're given something. Statutory silence. So, for instance, if there were a regime in which a statute said explicitly, okay, this is given exclusively to the district court, again, by the legislature, given exclusively to the district court, and then doesn't say anything more, then the silence would imply no right of review. But that silence on reviewability only applies once the legislature, again, the legislature, not the board, not the city of Fort Worth, only once that exclusive jurisdiction has been conveyed. Again, we're talking about overturning the original jurisdiction of the district courts. We don't do that lightly. So we don't simply say that anytime any agency ever does anything, that's unreviewable unless something's been given. There is no law, nothing that they have cited to you is going to support that proposition. What all those cases will support is when exclusive jurisdiction is conveyed. That's step one. Then number two, if no right of appellate review is provided by the legislature, then there is no right of appellate review.
It's your position that 6243I doesn't confer that exclusive jurisdiction?
It does for certain kinds of determinations. That is true, but it just none of those exclusive jurisdiction provisions apply to Mr. Layton's claims. They have just nothing to do with them. It doesn't, you know, again, 6243I doesn't actually assign anything to the board related to eligibility for benefits determinations. That is the determination that the board was doing, which is, you're a participating member, that is clear. You have met the vesting requirements, you worked for 5 years, but you don't, their decision says you didn't meet the disability requirements. And that is not an eligibility for benefits determinations. That is not a determination related to being a participating member. So it is not the exclusive jurisdiction that's been conveyed to the board.
Is it your position that you have ultra vires claims presently in your pleadings?
That is also, yes, something that I would say is incorrect. We pleaded violations of municipal ordinance and violations of municipal law and city ordinance specifically in our claims. So those are already in there. Moreover, we pled substantive due process claims, which are the right to an unbiased decision maker, and they didn't address those. They say that we only applied, you know, due process type claims, procedural due process. We also ask for substantive due process. But yeah, those things were already in the petition before we tried to amend. We've tried to add new parties, and we're barred to by the statutory stay that we've mentioned in our papers. But that doesn't impact anything before this court, and it doesn't change the fact there are ultra vires allegations in the present petition.
All right. And backing up just a second. The board's decision regarding eligibility is final. You're saying that that does not cover the determination of whether to reinstate the benefits?
So, two points on that, respectfully. First, if city ordinance says the board's decisions relating to eligibility are final, that makes no difference with regard to the original jurisdiction of the district court, because only the Texas legislature, only the Texas legislature can abrogate a coordinate branch of government's jurisdiction under the Texas Constitution. And that's Article 8, I believe we've cited in our brief. And on the second point, there is no exclusive jurisdiction. There has never been an exclusive jurisdiction, and we've cited cases for this in our reply, that covers violation when the board or the fund, when a governmental entity violates the law. When they do something unconstitutional, they can't shield that action by saying now it's unreviewable. There's a due process right to appellate review when there's an allegation that a governmental entity violated the statutes that give it power. If it's exceeded its powers, that's always reviewable.
But that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, then we are talking
like the outcome of the determination of whether or not he's still disabled.
Well, that's a statutory determination. I mean, if they're denying him benefits when he meets the statutory definition of disability, they've exceeded their powers, and this goes to something specific, that is, the board's discretion extends only so far as their actions are consistent with the ordinance or other applicable law, and for that. City ordinance. It's in section 2.5 of the city ordinance, creating the board and empowering it. So when they take an action that's inconsistent with municipal law, that is, if he's eligible for benefits under the ordinance, the plan, and he's denied, then they've exceeded their discretion. They have exceeded the power granted to them under the ordinance. So yes, by denying them benefits, they have exceeded their governmental power. In this instance, given this very specific provision, which gives them only a kind of limited discretion in how they're to administer benefits. I'm not saying that that's going to be the case in every single benefits determination under any fund. By and large, I think most of them are going to be unreviewable because they're much more specific about conveying that exclusive jurisdiction
okay.
to the board.
Any further questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Your case is submitted.
You need to take a break.
Thank you.